On behalf of Martin Boyce, left of me, and Frédéric de Delay, I would already congratulate you, first of all, to be so courageous to have stayed the whole day. I suppose that, just like the three of us, you would rather prefer some wild singing and dancing on stage than another debate on what already was called very contemptuously art and design. But okay, we'll try to manage, and we stick to a very strict timing. Let's say that first I give a small introduction, then Martin gives a small introduction to his work, and Frédéric also introduces his work with some images. And then we go for some fireworks and open debate in which you are also invited to participate. So I know that you're all tired, but I think that's been, and I would like to thank the organizers again for that. There's been so many things said today, and there's been so many interesting approaches from theoricians, which is kind of strange, because funny thing is the people from the practice always comes last. I don't know if you've noticed, but the artists and designers are in the last wagon, and the scientific people we've been listening to, they've almost all gone. I don't see, oh yeah, there's one left. But the other ones have gone. There's Alexander still sitting. I was just planning to say that in that way it's very difficult to get a kind of dialogue between theory and practice, but that's what we'll try, and we go for a very strict timing. So if you allow me to be so arrogant to start myself, I try to keep it short, and I would love to start with a kind of confession. I've been, as Tito told you, I've been working as a journalist from 85 to end of the 90s, writing about almost everything, mostly things I didn't know anything about. And that also explained maybe why I was so keen to write on art. I did that a long time until I grew tired, first of all, of journalism, and secondly, of art, because I got the impression that it was too much of a bubble, too much of a vacuum. And at the same time, though, I switched to design, hoping to touch ground again, because I was invited to become director of the Interior Foundation in Belgium. And since that, and that already proves that there is still a separation between the two. I've been stuck into design, if I want it or not. I've never been invited anymore to do anything that has to do with art, or almost not. And people always ask me to talk about design, much to my, I won't comment on that. But I can't deny that whenever, especially people that I haven't seen for years approach me and ask me what I'm doing, that I feel rather embarrassed, but I have to say them that I'm still into design. I've been wondering why that could be, and sometimes I got the feeling that from a noble profession I moved into becoming something like a pimp. It might have to do with the fact not only that design is the most ugly word that was ever invented over the last two centuries. It's just hideous, it's ugly. And it might have to do with the character, a specific character of design, which is a bastard character in every sense of the word. That's what I discovered after being some time in design. It's simply in the DNA. Ever since design has been invented as a kind of, the word design was launched, because it was already there for a long time. But since it was launched mid of the 19th century as a kind of synonym, word for all the tools of survival linked to the industrial revolution. It was born as a bastard child, in a way. The mother, everybody knows, it was the Industrial Revolution. But it was a mother with a kind of whorish reputation. She had many lovers, if you allow me to continue this metaphor. Plenty of lovers. They were called philosophy, sociology, and we've met them all today. Psychology, technology, marketing later on, and so on. And all of these lovers denied the fatherhood. No one wanted to accept and recognize the child as its own. But in secret, everybody kept on influencing the child, inspiring the child, supporting the child. That became, and design became, thanks to this injections, a world ruler, one might say. Like Tatiana just said, design today, it's everything. It's controlling our life into the smallest detail. So it's also controlling the outer world, one might say. It's been an evolution that is kind, and forgive me for jumping like that over decades, but it's an evolution in which, like, that in many ways was not that positive, in that sense that the motto that was on the coat of arms of design in the beginning, which was like form follows function, today has turned into a much more banal phrase, and that is sell whatever to whoever in whatever way. That's to design today. That made design today so powerful. We've seen many examples. We've many pieces of furniture today, but there was one piece of furniture that was omnipresent in almost all presentations, and that was a garden chair. That is indeed where you cannot say it's not a garden chair. It is the Aurora. I think in German it's called the Aurora chair. It's the monoblock chair. And I remember that a book written on the monoblock chair a few years ago, and they interviewed Werner Panton and Dieter Rams on it. And I think the organizers thought that they would, Rams and Panton would really criticize, destroy the chair in their comments. And both said, it's the ultimate chair. It's really what design deserves today, because it answers to all the criteria that have been even defended by modernism, up to the fact that it's available for everybody. It's the ultimate cheap chair, easy to make. You make it in, like Panton always dreamed of that, of just making a plastic chair in one flow. And he said, yeah, it's so much better. It's this anonymous piece of furniture is the ultimate result of design history. It's become, and I think that's also the reason why it has become for so many designers, young designers, a source of inspiration today. It has become the nullpunkt of design, the zero degree of design again, from where you can start to develop new things again, as we have seen. We've seen examples of front today. Martino Camper also did a variation in the pictures, and there were some more. We already mentioned the motto that was in the beginning ruling design also in modernism, and many of these young designers are trying to do away with an enormous misunderstanding around this form follows function motto that is attributed to Louis-Henri Sullivan, the architect, but is always misquoted because already it was form ever follows function, as he phrased it. And his example, the example he gave for form follows function, was a bird. So for him, the example of good design was a bird, was not the utility many people later associated with function. A bird is as utilitarian as a gorilla might be. It's just an organic being. But many designers today are of these young designers like Front, and we have two other examples sitting here, also an artist. They try to enlarge that limited idea of function to what I would call a whole series of other efforts, showing that function does not only stand for utility, but also for fiction, friction, fun, funk, fuck, fragility, fantasy, and so on. And I think that it might be a good starting point, Frederick, later on, to when we discuss your work. I shortly introduce you. You were born in Fribourg in 64, right? The funny thing is that we have here a designer whose work is for a great deal inspired by art. On the other hand, we have an artist who uses design objects as a reference in most of his work. When it comes to Frederick, you also call yourself a design detective. You published a book in which you incorporated two passions, your passion for design and photography. Can I say snapshots on in which ideas like surprise, the unexpected, play a major role, and you link many of your design pieces to this photography. Next to that, lost a bit my. I try to jump. As you're also going to present some pieces which you called with a reference to Andy Warhol also deeply superficial or melancholic objects. The other guest I have here is Martin Boyce. You were born in Scotland, Hamilton, in 67, and you just represented, or you're still representing, Scotland at the Venice Biennale this year. If I remember well, you once said that there was a moment when you thought that you might well become a designer, but you didn't. So you are an artist. Now, it doesn't prevent you from using, and in that way there's some kind of relationship with the show by Tatiana here. You use a lot of anonymous industrial elements like fences, neon lights, rubbish bins into your work, together with design classics, and that's something we really should discuss later on. Like the famous historical Eames leg splint that started their career beginning of the 40s during the Second World War, and Jacobson chairs, you rework them and appropriate them and use them in objects like masks, mobiles, but also in installations, landscapes that hover between the real and the imaginary, the dark and the reverie or something romantic, let's say, between the public and the personal. also. But I'd rather leave that to you to explain that more. In any way, you use these objects to question not only the objects themselves, but also the politics and the ethics that made them, that introduced them to the world, really. To finish my introduction, I've had the impression today that maybe we've been discussing for a long time the sex of the angels today, while we were discussing design and art. Tito, you said at a certain moment in the 20th century there were three major moments. First, there was the breakup of... There was a moment, the Gesamtkunstwerk, at the first moment, then the breaking up, and then now there's the try to approach again. What you've forgotten, in a way, I think, was that that for a long time, and even until 30 or 40 years ago, there was no problem at all. Art and design were considered to be linked together, like you would have like Adam Cain or something inseparable, Adam and Eve. It was a duo that was always together. You already had it like in the 18th century. You had les arts décoratifs, decorative ornamental arts. It was always, they were always together. They were not considered to be different. They were considered to be the same thing. So today during lunch with Frederick Gottlieb, we tried to find out the moment when this separation took place. It was not with modernism, but because like Stahl, Bauhaus, Russian constructivism still had this vision in which both were considered to be one and the same. So when did this happen? It might be an interesting question to discuss. Also to see, but it's interesting to know that what we are discussing is here, so this separation between the two, is something that maybe happened only the last 20 or 30 years, not earlier. Maybe a bit earlier, last half century, not to exaggerate. Okay, that's maybe it. A last remark. I think maybe the difference is that art is a lot about negation. We discussed that with Martin also. He said yesterday, there is also something that design cannot, almost not express. It's like something like tragedy. That's something that is not in the range of design. There might be difference there. Freedom is another thing. Art is a lot about freedom next to negation. Design, as it was said also during the last discussion, but then Tatiana also said my exhibition is about constraints. Design is much more about constraints. The problem is that many of these utilitarian, especially utilitarian ones, constraints have been become totally obsolete. And it leaves today design in a kind of vacuum where art was in before. So for the designer has the question, what shall he do? When, like Martin, when you wanted to become a designer, you also discovered, why invent another chair when there's already so many to sit on? Sorry for the long introduction again. Can't leave it, but I leave it to Martin and Frederick now to introduce their work. Who starts?
Martin.
Martin?
Okay. We thought it would be useful. I don't know how many people are familiar with my work, so I thought it would be useful to show very quickly some pieces that relate directly to the topic of the symposium. This is a piece called Phantom Limb. It's made from an Eden's plywood leg split and I became very interested in initially, particularly in Charles Green's, and at the point I became interested in the work. I think it was no accident that there was a sort of resurgence of interest. It was becoming sort of repopularized. Initially, I didn't know whether design or the history of design or any aspect of design would enter my art practice. It might just end up being something that I was simply interested in. But I kind of started looking at these design objects and thinking about how they entered the world in a sort of conditional, like, sort of utopian kind of desire for sort of mass production of the post-war kind of situation, and sort of mass production, like good design, and at affordable prices and so on. And I started to look at these objects as they kind of exist in the world now, and it became clear that as those objects carried through, as they journeyed through time, their original ethos or ideology had been sort of slowly stripped away and essentially replaced by an ideology of value, of taste, they become decorative, collectible, and expensive. And so there was this tension between the two things, and this was my way in, initially, my way into sort of using some of these objects. I also then became interested in the landscapes that these objects might occupy. So the shape of this piece is, it's as close as I could. It's Charles Eden's wife, Rains, who they worked very closely together. But she came from an art background, and she made a number of sculptures from, she carved a number of sculptures from the Eden's light squint, and they were painted black. And so I replicated one of her sculptures, and they have this kind of slightly anthropomorphic kind of form. And I painted it white and then suspended it, and it became this sort of ghost-like form. And of course, the light splint itself was designed for wounded servicemen from the US Navy. So already the object has this sort of traumatic history. And and of course, the term phantom limb is the sense of feeling a limb when the limb's absent. So this idea of the ghost or the phantom sort of became interesting to me. And in a way, it was like this hollowed out. It sort of also reflected this kind of hollowed out ideology that these objects now had.
Yep. Oh, yeah, sorry. And it's quite heavy.
So this is another example of a piece made from an Eames leg split. I mean, one of the other things is certainly when I started making these pieces, which was around the first split piece was from 98. I bought a leg split while in Los Angeles, and it was kind of sitting in my room, and I just kind of thought, here's this medical object that I'm sort of using sort of as a decorative object. So my urge was to somehow engage with it and sort of continue its history. And I was interested in somehow also expressing this idea of exoticism that I began to see with these objects as well. It also became very popular in the 50s to display tribal or African masks in sort of modernist kind of settings. And I was sort of interested in kind of flipping that round. And then in the case of the leg splints, that the exoticism of the object was sort of produced by the passing of time rather than geographical or cultural distance. So this became this Western language kind of mask. This is an installation, this is now jumping forward sometimes from, I think, 2004. And it kind of contains a number of chairs that I made. So all the elements of the installation are fabricated. I'm hesitant to use the word design because it might lead to some confusion. But I guess, you know, they were fabricated, you know, to my specifications, rather than there's no pre-existing objects. I've been invited to work on a project where artists have been invited to make chairs, and one of the things I did before I made the chair was I had that question, why do we even have a chair? So I decided to give me a way in that I would invent a fictional location and then make the chair for that location. So the installation is titled for 1959 Capital Avenue, which is almost this generic address from a sort of notional metropolis. So in a way, the chair becomes it's a lobby chair. So you produce the chair produces the lobby produces the architecture. The text that ran around the wall, this is just one word, but it read "punching through the clouds," which is a sort of quote attributed to Mies van der Rohe as a description of the kind of soaring optimism of the glass tower. But post 9/11, of course, "punching through the clouds" sort of had taken on a slightly more sinister sort of possibility, certainly in relation to the tower, you know, in relation to architecture. And this is a kind of source image which, you know, allows me to introduce the next body of work. And really, since 2005, I've been working almost exclusively with a body of work that refers back to this object. And this is one of four concrete trees that were made by Jan and Joel Martel for the exhibition of the Decorative Arts in Paris in 1925. And it was just one of these things. I come across an image of it, and the only existing images they're long since destroyed. And I just kept coming back to it. And I started to make models of this, models of these trees to try and understand their kind of system. And I was very interested in that they sort of represented this collapse of architecture and nature. So you have the very urban texture of concrete, and of course the abstracted form of the tree. Natural object. So the first piece I made is this photographic piece. The first piece I made in relation to the Martel tree was this piece. It's titled "Concrete Autumn and Phantom Tree." So it's another ghost. And I guess my desire was not to go back in time to revisit the tree, but was to somehow bring the tree now. So this, the idea was that the tree was reappearing as a phantom now. And then I've made a whole number of works which, using the kind of shapes, I began to use the shapes of the tree as almost as a kind of lexicon, as a kind of modular system or language. To the extent that I've made a typography that that directly comes from the shapes and forms of the tree. So this is the last couple of images. These are all from the installation in Venice at the Biennale. So I think there's seven or eight rooms of a. It was the top floor of a 15th century palazzo. And when I first saw this space, because you're so high up and with the windows open and it was completely empty, for some reason I started to think of the space as like an abandoned garden. And this was the first. This was the first idea that then formed the rest of the work. And in each of the room there was the glass, you know, the Murano glass chandeliers. So the first pieces that I decided upon was to replace the glass chandeliers with my sculptural versions. And these, actually, then it's probably the first time in all the work since the photographic piece that the tree has been made and it's been remade in its entirety. So each chandelier is the form of the concrete tree, but inverted with lights inserted. So they function as an uplighting of chandeliers. But the show is titled "No Reflections," and the first room you go into has these stepping stones, so you can actually walk through the room on these stepping stones. So there's these paper I guess, sculptural equivalents of autumn leaves scattered throughout the space. So the room becomes a dried out pool, and the chandeliers potentially become these negated reflections. The wooden piece is a sort of classic. I always think of it as a sort of Parisian, but a sort of classic double-sided bench. There's two of them that have been made and then upended, and so they become a screen. So they refer to, you know, maybe to alto or the Eames screen. It starts to animate what happens on the other side of the screen, of course, and you start to kind of deal with glimpses of people moving past. Another chandelier piece, and then the table. So the tabletop is made from two intersecting, the same shapes that are the diagonal sloping leaf forms from the tree. There's a silkscreen print. The table is perforated and the legs are partially rusted from the bottom up. So again, it's somewhere between an industrial table, very large, or a garden table. And the steel is very worn and weathered. It appears to have come in contact with the elements. And again, the rust sort of notionally introduces time and the elements to the sculpture. And the tabletop is made of perforated steel. And then in one of the other rooms, you have the table frame. And on the back, you can see, on the wall, you can see some of the typography. These are made in brass. So the full text read petrified songs. So, you know, if you're going to have concrete trees, then this idea that the songs of the birds were sort of suspended in the air and frozen. Maybe we'll leave it there, and we can start talking soon.
Okay. Frederick. We leave the questions for later on.
Where is my document? Here? Sorry. God. Should work.
You're on screen.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
It's already open.
Yeah. Is it? Where is it open? I don't see it. Here. Okay, thanks. Okay. I'm trained. Can you stop the DIA show, the slideshow? It's moving by itself.
Just have to stop with that.
Okay, Mike. Oh, you have to go the other way.
What's that way? Just have to and press that one.
This one, okay, perfect.
Time for playing.
Great. I'm trained as an industrial designer, as an industrial designer, you mostly have to do with constraints that come from the client or from the brief or from the material you're working with or from the function the object you are designing has to fulfill. And as a designer, you have to find the best possible answer around those imposed constraints, which is actually the beauty of design. But sometimes, as a designer, you just wish you would be completely free. That's when designers envy artists, and you feel like generating your own brief and working on themes that, or defining your own constraints completely independently from a client or from a brief. And that's something that I've started doing a few years ago. It's probably now 4 years ago. I felt the need to add a different category of projects in my work, not only working for the furniture industry, for instance, or conceiving exhibition architecture for museums, or conceiving furniture for very specific spaces, but developing objects that would be much freer, that would be for me a kind of laboratory, and just doing them for myself, basically, with maybe with the hope that this kind of work would influence my other projects as well. And for tonight's talk, I've chosen three projects, and two of these projects are those free projects. And one is actually a piece of furniture that I've designed, which had a special fate, which you will see later on. The first project I'd like to introduce are the deeply superficial objects. Those are objects made out of styrofoam, and they're covered with a two-component glaze. And what I was interested in, I came to do this almost by accident, because the first of these objects I made for as furniture for an exhibition, but I didn't glaze it. It was just a bare styrofoam, and I thought it was appropriate for a temporary exhibition because it would deteriorate with time. But I thought this was okay. It would make a statement also about time passing and the fact that this furniture was not forever. But I liked these pieces so much that after that exhibition was over, I looked for a solution to make them more stable, because the material was not stable enough to last longer than 3 months. So I looked for a way of stabilizing the material, and found this two-component glaze that fulfills the function of stabilizing the surface. But that was not enough. I didn't just want to coat these objects to make them last longer. I thought I would have to build in another meaning into those objects by the way this glaze is applied. And as the title of the objects, deeply superficial objects, is a paradox. How can you be deep and superficial at the same time? But that's exactly what I was interested in: built in a paradox into or contradiction into the appearance of these objects. The shapes are very precise. The computer aided cut, and then I poured the glaze by hand myself, like a craftsman, onto those objects, and the glaze is flowing along these shapes, destroying or contrasting with the precision of those shapes. And this is only one of the contradictions in this project. There's also another one, and these objects remind of ceramic objects, but they're not. They're glazed, but they're not ceramics. They look heavy, but they're light. So I was interested in making a theme out of all these contradictions, which is something that you usually don't do in design. When you design an object as an industrial designer, you want to design an object that is very obvious, that communicates what it is as precisely and as clearly as possible. So this was trying to contradict my own field of work in a way. So I hope I do this right. the next one. Okay. This is another image of these objects. I'm just going to go through real quick. Well, they're all different. Maybe what I can say about these objects is that that's too fast. Okay. These objects are not as design objects. I don't see this as art. I mean, these objects can be used as small side tables. That's what I see them as. I don't see them as works of art. This has to be very clear. I'm not an artist. I'm still a designer, even though there might be a slightly more artistic approach in those objects than in pure industrial design projects. But these objects need a different. They cannot be sold in a furniture store. It doesn't work. The public of a design store doesn't understand, or most of the public wouldn't. The audience of a furniture store wouldn't understand these objects. Plus, they're quite expensive in the production, so they're not commercially viable in the context of furniture store, which is why I looked for a gallery to sell these objects, and that's one common point with the art world. Now, design, a certain type of design. Design is a very wide field, and for certain type of design, you need to find the right way to get your audience, and this project I'm working with a design gallery here in Zurich, the Franziska Kessler Gallery, and that's interesting for me to see that the awareness of design, whether you show it in a gallery or in a furniture store, is a totally different one, and that it needs a specific context to communicate certain type of design works. Maybe we can talk about this later. Yep. A little bit more. Let's go further. Being too slow. Okay, that's not in the right order, but it doesn't matter. This is a one-off piece that I designed for the gallery Mark Müller here in Zurich. And this is another. These are also special projects as a designer. When you design just a unique piece, and the reason why it's unique is that the shape of this seat is defined by the skin of by a leather skin that I had, and I designed the shape of the seat according to avoiding all the mistakes in that leather skin. So the shape is basically due to the defects in that skin, and is not voluntary. It's almost by chance. You know? And what happened to this object is interesting, and that's the link to the art world. Yeah, that's this image. Oops, I forgot to stop it. My seat was integrated in an art installation by the artist Katharina Grosse. So we're back to Martin in a way. And I must confess, I was quite shocked at first when I saw what had happened to my piece of furniture.
Did she apply the colors? Then?
Yeah. She sprayed.
Nice.
She sprayed the piece of furniture, but in at first I was totally shocked. I had no idea that she was going to do this, but I quite liked the result in a way, and it was. She's been adding a layer of meaning to my work, so it was really, really interesting.
Okay.
And last project that I want to show is a vase, a vessel, which is actually. This is something I just did the last month, and this project has to do. with the deeply superficial objects in a way. It's the same type of shapes, but it's a totally different material. And it's been influenced, I mean, the common element is probably the randomness of the surface. This object is called melancholic object number one. In this object, I tried to work with elements that also usually don't appear in design. The surface is completely raw. It's sand cast in bronze, and the surface is completely due to the process and due to the material used. So it's the negation of what you're trying to achieve in the industrial production, which I thought was quite interesting to do as a designer. Just try to deny the ideals of the profession.
It doesn't look like it's accidental that it is a vase. Let me explain. You work there with a lot with the idea of imperfection. It looks a bit what is with a fashionable world that is often also very much misunderstood by the whole style world, wabi-sabi culture, Japanese culture, in which imperfection is a major quality, is an essential quality. Yeah. Which is opposed to what the design world has always thought that, or the industrial design idea, because I think that's a major problem with symposiums. What are we talking about? What is design? There's so many notions. But there is an industrial notion, and most industrial notions have this idea that a design object should be perfect. And whole cultures have been wiped away. When I think about Japan, the whole traditional culture in which imperfection was perfection. A broken vase was better than a new vase. And this looks a lot linked to that, especially since a vase in Japanese culture is so important as a symbol.
Absolutely. I mean, wabi-sabi is something I very much admire. Also the entire culture of Japanese crafts, and it has had an influence of my on this work as well. But maybe just afterwards, I'll just give you the the word again. But imperfection in art is something that's been accepted for a long time, and I thought this was interesting to work with imperfection as a designer, so that's another level where I'm maybe reaching you a hand, but it doesn't make me an artist. I think this is important. I want to repeat it. I'm still a designer.
On the other hand, when you make deeply superficial objects, it was Warhol who called himself a deeply superficial artist.
Person,
So that's a clear reference also to that. Why do you call them deeply superficial, apart from this reference? It makes me think of another major opposition in discussion on design and art, the ornament is crime discussion, in which ornament was declared a crime because it was so superficial in the industrial Western point of view. Is it also a reference to that, or a celebration of surface?
It's more the celebration of this contradiction, but it's also the celebration of the surface, because in those deeply superficial objects there are two surfaces on top of each other. There's the perfect surface of the styrofoam geometrical object, and then the random surface of the glaze applied onto it. So and it has a transparency. The glaze has a transparency which gives the object a depth as well. But I was mostly interested in that contradiction.
How important is randomness? Are ideas like randomness imperfection for, in your work?
Yeah, I'm not so, I mean, randomness it doesn't figure so much in what I do, but I don't know if I would call it imperfection, but you know, a lot of the work in Venice, I artificially or accelerated the process of rusting or weathering the steel and the wood and the different things. So also there's a, right from some very early works, there's this idea of things being broken kind of really interests me. I've made a number of objects that are broken or damaged. So, and I guess, you know, you, by doing that, you introduce a story, you introduce a narrative, you introduce I'm very interested in the idea that an object can sort of contain, you know, can have a sort of emotional or a psychological makeup, you know. Like, you know, can you make a paranoid chair?
And in a way, a function, because you describe your landscape as a kind of internal park, as an exhibition is a park. Yeah. People can walk in, and even if they got three children with them, the experience of walking with the children and the screaming and shouting of the children is part of their experience. Yeah. But you accept them and really would love to stimulate in a way.
Yeah.
So you have this very utilitarian almost conception of exhibition, different from what normally. Normally, like in exhibition, maybe here or so, you have this noli me tangere in Latin attitude of art. Don't touch me.
Well, I mean that issue is also a kind of difficult one because I didn't show slides of it, but I made an installation in Glasgow in a place called Tramway, which is it's an old tram shed, and so it's a vast space, and I made a work that, as you said, sort of fragmented park landscape, and I made parklet, I made benches, and in that case, I made a decision that most of the benches were just bench frames, but some had some strips of wood so they could be sat on. So the decision was: do we allow people to sit on the benches, or are they sculptures, or what? You know, what do we do? And in that instance, I kind of decided that people could sit on the benches. But in the installation for 1959 Capitol Avenue with the kind of lobby situation, I really wanted to create a really cold and hard, you know, sort of frozen atmosphere. And so the decision, and this is something that remains a constant, is that the work isn't to be used, doesn't function in its conventional sense. So we had to tell the...
Is it there to limit the space? When I see your trees, for instance, and if I was recently reminded, you didn't show your neon light trees, which is maybe the most typical you have, but the nakedness and spareness and skeleton atmosphere of that tree reminded me immediately of the Waiting for Godot, the first scenography done for that, which was like two clowns and a naked tree that made the whole stage. Seeing your trees, you have almost the same impression. You put one naked tree, just some metal and some neon lights, and it turns the whole gallery into a desert, yeah, in a way, like this tree that it does in the Waiting for Godot piece. So is it more about that, creating... You also have, you work with these
fences.
Yeah.
They divide the space into.
Yeah, I just. I
was, but it's allowed or not.
I just became really interested in, you know, I make fences, but I also make pieces that are ventilation grills. And so the two things I think of in a similar way is that they can function as thresholds. And they function as kind of filters. So you viewing, you know, in the case of the fence pieces, you have to kind of negotiate it physically, but also it alters the view of whatever lies on the other side of it. In the case of the ventilation grill pieces, it kind of notionally introduces you to the unseen guts of the architecture. So it extends the room that you're in, and it also introduces the possibility of the room breathing. So you have something very... kind of animate the architecture by the presence of these objects.
Would you be hurt as an artist when I would say that these that when design would become like this, or could become like what you are doing with objects, then this would become design? Would you be hurt by that, or would you be so?
It's a difficult one. I mean, it comes back to the question of, and I don't think it's as simple as this, but context, you know. Yeah.
Because in a way, it's functional. It's functional in
yeah,
space.
Yeah, but also, for me, there's also this question of tension that I'm very interested in. You know, because I have made a number of outdoor pieces, but you know, it's a real difficulty because of the language. A great deal of the language that I'm using come from public spaces. You know, so it's urban kind of street furniture or from an outdoor kind of situation. So as soon as you put those pieces, you know, that as soon as you put them outdoors, it's kind of like, you know, putting a pen in a balloon. You know, that tension is gone because, you know, a bench sculpture outside becomes a bench. You know,
yeah.
So there is that element of and it is a kind of, there's a fragility there. You know, but I think also it's the context of the body of work that keeps it kind of grounded.
Do you see still a difference between art and design? As it is.
Yeah.
Especially in the beginning of your career, you were thinking,
am
I a designer? Am I not?
And no, I mean, that was. I mean, at one point, I think, you know, a tutor kind of had recognized it, said, why don't you? You should go into design, you should go into textile design or industrial design or something. And really, what attracted me to the department that I went into was the people in the department. The other students that even before I knew them, it was the way, you know, the way they looked, the way the work that I saw them produce, and I went into a very unusual department, which was, it's called environmental art, which is kind of a misleading kind of title, but essentially it was about art, art about context. The context was 50% of the work. That was one of the mantras, you know, of the department, and it was geared very much towards public art. And the students kind of rebelled against that, and so it became ultimately a mixed media department, or basically it became a department where people did whatever they felt like doing. There was no restraints, which is essentially, you know, which is how people, which is how artists it's how artists make work. You know, like, the idea of having a painting department and a sculptural department seems kind of crazy, but it's still how most art schools are run. But this department kind of allowed you to do anything, allowed you to make a film or, you know, make a performance or, you know, work in any way that you wanted to. And so it became quite clear to me that, you know, by entering that department and engaging with those ideas, that if I wanted to make a chair, I can make a chair. If I wanted to, you know, build a house, I can build a house. If I want to make a hat, I can make a hat. You know, it was, all of these things could be included in that practice.
So in this sense, I mean, art has been using the tools of design and of a lot of other disciplines for a long time, and design is sort of a little bit back in time, and is only now starting to discovering that it can use tools from other disciplines as well.
But I think also it's, you know, design, it's like, it's just, you know, you can call it design, but it's the built environment. It's almost everything. You know, when was the last time you opened your eyes and didn't see anything that had been produced? You know, even to the extent that most, you know, you can open your eyes in a forest, but it might not be a natural forest. You know, it
might be a park.
So, it, you know, it's like when Robert Goldberg made a bag of donuts, nobody said, God, he's a baker now. You know, he's not an artist. It's, you know, for me, it just feels like it's a way of creating space, a way of articulating space or describing possibilities and by the use of the object. So you know what kind of room you're in by the chair that's in it. You know, so it becomes about space and landscape.
What I'm still amazed about is this Eames prosthesis element. First of all, do you use original ones? No.
Yeah. I mean, there are
there so many.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, but they must have. They must have made. You know, they must have been so mass produced. And as I understand that, the first time I was in LA was in '96, and I think at that time, someone had literally kind of unlocked a warehouse and found a warehouse full of them.
Yeah. Okay. So you've used half of them already.
But they're not even so expensive.
But did you know that it was such a historically important piece? First of all, it started off the career of the Eameson. Secondly, it's one of the best examples of that shows that war is one of the major motifs of design history. This one is probably the best example. It started off their career, but also changed the course of history after the Second World War. And did you know all that? The symbolism of this. On top of that, it's a prosthesis. It's like you say, it's a phantom. It's there, it's not there.
I guess that's something.
Was it just intuition?
It was when I was studying at CalArts. I was just there for one semester, and it was turned out to be a love with these things. You know, because it was, you know, it making that first cut was pretty. You know, it was kind of difficult. But of course, once you get beyond that. And also you understand that you're taking an object and you're just continuing its narrative, and that became very interesting. I mean, Sherry Levine had already made a piece in advance of The Broken Leg, you know, after Duchamp, just by showing one of the splints. So it already entered the art canon.
This phantom atmosphere you want to give to your work makes me think of what Alexander yesterday said in his speech. Did you feel any? Do you recognize anything, Alexander, in what Martin is saying about this phantom, ghostly atmosphere he wants to add to his work in relationship to your idea of the shine or the semblance? You're too tired.
No, I had an idea, although I think it was something unrelated
to that. Sorry. Because in a way we come close again to when I have it well, your interpretation you gave yesterday was a kind of scientific very phenomenology colored interpretation of the old aura theory, in which it is said an object, art or design, is the making, and then you have the aura, something that is sublime or the shine that is around it. Although I think it's much more negative in approach, and what you say is also like it's also a semblance around it. It's ghostly phantom atmosphere in which the presence is there and the presence is an absence and so on.
Yeah, I mean, also this idea, which is not a new idea, but the idea that the space in between two objects is as important as the objects themselves. So quite often it's about charging the space as much. You know, that's how the sculptures function, is that they kind of charge the space depending on how they're configured.
That's something as a designer where you're really stuck with it. You cannot almost work in function of a space. Your parameters, space, the specific space, does not often belong to your parameters, except when you're an interior designer and you make first a sofa in function of a space and then okay.
If you design furniture, you have to think about the relationship of the piece of furniture to the space in terms of proportions, in terms of size, in terms of function as well. I think this the space is a very important notion in design, especially in furniture design. But it's an aspect that's not taken into consideration enough. by it's something you're not taught in the industrial design departments. You know, you talk about other references or examples in the design history, but you don't learn much about the context, the spatial context where these objects are supposed to function. It's something that you have to learn by yourself.
Do we agree that we should keep a difference between the two words, art and design?
For me,
and if so, what's the difference? What could be the difference?
I mean, as I've kind of said, because of course the question comes up a lot in relation to what I do, and you know, on one hand, to try and define art design, immediately limits the possibilities of both. But it depends what we're talking about. If we're talking about the kind of radical edges of design practice, or are we talking about the kind of mainstay of industrial design? So of course there's points where it gets close, but for me it's just, you know, if I was an architect, even if I was really good, I wouldn't want someone to say this, you know, he's now an artist, you know, and this does happen, because I just think it's descriptively inaccurate, you know.
Yesterday you told me design cannot express tragedy, for instance. Another difference could be that or an advantage, even if, especially when you're still linked to industrial production, is that you can make an object, and there we come again to that bastard nature of design, vicious nature also. It can be like a virus. You can make a vase, you can make like Ilja Jongerius for IKEA. You can make them in 100,000, and they spread all over the world in living rooms of the people, where they start nagging, whispering after some time. They start to manifest themselves and behave badly and ugly in the best of cases. So they become bad spirits. That's something art cannot do. So there are differences in a way.
Yeah,
should we respect
maybe people? Maybe we should ask the audience.
Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe it's time the audience reacts or ask questions.
Yeah. Sorry, Alexander. Sorry. Can you repeat that?
Why he ended up liking what the artist did to his fluid skin?
Well, I think I like the entire installation more than I like the intervention on my piece of furniture specifically. I'm sorry? No, I'm trying to be precise, because what happened is that after the installation was dismantled, my piece of furniture was in the space by itself, sprayed, and it didn't really work anymore. You know, it only worked in the context of the entire installation. So actually, now it should go back to its original surface. But it worked as a part of the installation. And for me it was interesting to observe how I reacted to this kind of rape of my work. You know, it had something very violent in a way, which I had not expected.
Why did you like the rape? What did you like?
Well, I thought it was interesting what was happening. If I liked it or not is actually not important. It's not relevant. But it was definitely interesting, because all of a sudden my work, there was another level of meaning added to my work. So this, I thought this was an interesting phenomenon.
Any other questions? Microphone.
Designers that directly feed into the work, and I guess, you know, those are also designers that I like or that I'm interested in. But I do think that I'm interested in what happens to, I'm interested in design in relation to now, whether it's a design that was made in 1950 or whether the design was made yesterday. But, so I'm always interested in what happened, the time in relation to these things, and how the culture around it kind of affects it. So it's a combination of things. You know, I think also for me, it's, you know, when design started to be exhibited and not used, then you know, something quite interesting happens to the object. You know, and like when you see a Jean Prouvé table in a design gallery, it really gets very close to the status of sculpture, because its individual patina of use and age, you know, makes it individual, it makes it exotic, and quite often also, particularly with Jean Prouvé, is that it might even be shown without its tabletop. So you're actually, you know, you're looking at it as an object. And this, you know, I made some sculptures based on the Eames shelving units, because, you know, they were a modular system, and of course they have this relationship with Mondrian and so on. So, you know, it was. I could sense something in their objectness that was interesting to me in relation to sculpture, rather than exclusively their history or use. I'm trying to think of this. New designers or current designers that are interesting. They're certainly in their area. I think we talked about Konstantin Grinczyk yesterday, the pros and cons of some of his work.
You don't like his latest chair?
I mean, it's interesting because also, you know, we had this discussion about use and can an object be used if it's not functioning? You know, I have this sort of, you know, this Castiglione light which has the car headlamp, and I really, really love this light, but I never switch it on because it's too bright.
That's because your room is too small.
No, I have a very, very high ceiling. It's just, I really kind of switch it on, but it's sort of, it still functions for me in the space in a different kind of way. And I'm still really interested in the Konstantin Grinczyk, the new injection molded cantilever chair. I think there's something very interesting about it. I like the way it looks. I think it's really heavy and not very comfortable, which is a bit of a drawback for a chair. But beyond that, there's, you know, again, there's enough that kind of interests me in it.
We should stop. Any more? No more questions? Is everybody
so
dead?
We're all clear on the subject. So we've cracked that one. Mix the environment.
So, if there are no questions, I would like to thank everybody first who has stayed so long here and listened to them. And I would like to thank also everybody who came here on this occasion. And thanks very much for speaking here, for speaking about the issue since yesterday. And I would like also to thank again the New Museum for taking as the host today. And thank you very much.
Maybe when we have some time and energy left to take. I was just thinking that in a way it's mostly a language problem. What we're discussing about these words, art and design, and it's kept alive by two industries that have an interest in keeping the difference. There's a design industry, there's an art industry, but also often the thinking is not coming from the object itself. That's something that struck me in many in the lecture yesterday and today also. When you think from in terms of an object and the way it can function as a catalyzer, almost all these definitions collapse, and the way an object can work on a viewer as a catalyzer, and so often I have the impression that we are talking about the sex of angels when we are discussing art and design and architecture and so on.
That's the title of the next symposium.